If you're looking for adventure this summer, escape with Marvel Comics. Fight crime with Spider-Man. Meet the Fantastic Four and watch Captain America in action. May the Force be with you as you battle the evil empire in Star Wars. Discover the secrets of the South American jungle in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And with Marvel Comics, you're never alone because they can go with you in the car or to the park, even on a rainy day. Marvel Comics are your ticket to fun and adventure this summer.
Welcome to Dave's Marvel Universe. I'm your host, J. David Weider, and according to my contract with the Utah Board of Sanitation, I am required to say that you can call me Dave. As is the usual, this show has a simple, stupid simple idea, really. A dream, if you will. To read and talk about comics published by Marvel in the decade of the 1980s. This time around, we are looking at Iron Man, who is an international superstar kicked off the MCU and a household name now, but that wasn't always the case. Compared to my encounter with Spider-Man, my origin with Iron Man is a bit lackluster, just to be completely upfront with you. As a kid, and I'm talking about 5 or 6, I would spend a lot of time at my cousin's house, and we would team up He-Man, G.I. Joe, and Fisher-Price Little People, which you wouldn't think would work, but it really, really does, especially when you throw in the Star Wars characters. And my cousin had a massive comic book collection. To say he was light years ahead of me is an understatement. This cousin, down the road a few years, when we were teenagers, brought me into his room, plopped a copy of X-Men number 1 in my hands, as in the original 1963 X-Men number 1. This kid was using bags and boards at 6 and 7 when I was just grabbing books off the spinner rack at the local convenience store, so he was light years ahead of me. He had just gotten some new comics in, and I noted one that was interesting. It was an Iron Man comic, and he was appalled that I had never heard of Iron Man. Like, dubious of my claim, I had to know who this guy was. He puts his armor in his suitcase. Come on, dude. But no, had never heard of Iron Man. He was also shocked that I'd never heard of Rom Space Knight. But unlike Rom Space Knight, Iron Man kind of grabbed a little bit of my attention. He was never a top 10 character. I leaned more towards the Hulk and Captain America and Spider-Man and, of course, Daredevil. But unlike Rom Space Knight, I did maintain some interest in Iron Man. Now, that really came to kind of a sear, if you will, where it sealed in at the same time as Doctor Doom. They really both grabbed me through the Mattel Secret Wars toy line. You have two armored people, one hero, one villain. Their figures were pretty lateral in a lot of ways in terms of armor. And not knowing a lot when those toys came out, based on the shield art, things like that, I assumed that these two were arch enemies. And it really worked. Saying that would be selling Dr. Doom short, because Doom is everybody's arch enemy. He's that benevolent. I'm going to be talking about Dr. Doom a little bit more in next episode, but suffice it to say these two became known quantities to me, and that fandom kind of grew and grew. Now, I'm excited about this episode because it's my first two-parter, but also because a pastor at my church wanted me to do a full-on Iron Man podcast. I can't do that, but I am doing this so I can teach him a few things. One of the reasons Iron Man stayed with me, and likely why he's still popular today, is because for a character born of the 1960s Cold War, he remains relevant. Iron Man was very much a thinly disguised allegory for the space race and the rising tensions between communists and democracy. It was a time where he who had the biggest toys is the most secure. And that really becomes clear when Black Widow made her first appearance in an Iron Man comic. She was a Russian spy sent to steal Tony Stark's tech. And let me just point out that her partner in that issue was Boris. So yes, you had Boris and Natasha, and that is Marvel canon, people. Boris and Natasha. No Moose and Squirrel in this one, though. The same stories he told in the early days were still relevant in the 1980s. The Cold War was still on, the space race was more about shooting down nuclear missiles, and it was more who has the biggest weapons. But that echo remained. It still remains to this day because you have Iron Man who is looking more at technology in terms of drone strikes and privacy and Silicon Valley and internet stuff. So he's a bit of an evergreen character. But in the 1980s, bear in mind the Cold War was very much still on, very much public, and people of a certain age will remember when we had nuclear bomb tests. This is where they would have you dive under your desk and curl up into a ball. Because a Formica desk is going to do so much for a nuclear blast. They just like giving kids a false sense of hope, I guess. Now, in this issue, we're going to see several things. We're going to see Tony in the boardroom. We're going to see some unscrupulous business decisions made in his company in terms of dealing with a foreign nation, a potentially threatening foreign nation. And we're going to see some international laws potentially get broken by Tony Stark himself. So it's an exciting issue. And it comes to a really interesting ending, which is going to build for next issue, which is a completely different story in terms of tone, in terms of subject matter. It takes a huge left turn. But I'm going to take a quick podcast promo break to pimp somebody else's show, and then I'll be back to look at Iron Man versus Doctor Doom.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
Welcome back. Iron Man number 149 is our book this time around, with an August 1981 cover date. The cover itself is by John Romita Jr. and Bob Layton. And here we have an extreme close-up of Doom's face mask, looking directly into his eye slits behind that metal, and reflected in that big oversized eye is Iron Man flying directly at him and the audience. This is intensely close to Doom's face, close enough that I never actually want to be there. Because he looks very angry, extremely angry, and I feel like I failed Doom, and I never ever want to fail Doom. But to be serious, this is a really good composition. It's not 100% original because we've seen the enemy reflected in the eyeball before, but this is really pulled off well. It has an intensity level that is off the charts, and it feels geared towards a great action-oriented issue. Which this actually kind of is. Inside the cover is a story entitled Doom Quest, written by David Michelinie, co-plotted and inked by Bob Layton, penciled by John Romita Jr., lettered by Joseph Rosen, with colors by Bob Sharon. And I'm going to be upfront with you. This particular synopsis, I did not write myself. I actually pulled it off a wiki, which is rare, because ultimately those wiki synopses tend to be extremely long and labored and detailed, and it's not necessary for a runtime of my show. I like to keep it fairly brief, in and out. So this time I was feeling pretty lucky, so I'm going to give credit to whoever wrote the wiki, and we're going to dive into my brief synopsis now. Iron Man saves a Stark International cargo ship from a band of terrorists, then instructs it to turn around and head home without delivering its cargo. Later, Tony holds a meeting with heads of Stark International's plant chiefs and confronts Zero about selling electronics to Latveria, and Tony fires Zero. Centuries in the past, Dr. Doom visits Cagliostro to increase his mystical knowledge, then uses his time machine to return to the present. Doom's servant, Hotman, who secretly hates Doom for slaying his brother, explains that Stark has withdrawn the booster circuits which they need to send Doom further back in time. Doom sends a manned attack vehicle to steal the circuits, and his agents manage to overcome Iron Man. Tony goes to Latveria to confront Doom, and the local military welcome him, being currently led by King Zorba Fortunov, glad to interfere with Doom's plans. Iron Man heads to Castle Doom and overcomes Doom's robot guards, and faces Dr. Doom himself, and they do battle. But when they accidentally pause on the time machine platform, Hotman activates the device and sends them to the past, and then smashes the machine, stranding them there. Alright, as usual, I'm going to start at the beginning of the issue, which seems like a logical place to begin, with the opening. We have a group of helicopter-flying pirates attacking a shipment. And Michelinie uses the text to point out something really interesting, at least to me. It was a thoughtful piece that didn't overwhelm the story, but stayed with me. fiction and other pop culture tends to show piracy on the high seas as romantic, adventurous, so on and so forth. But in reality, it's terrorism. Which in the 21st century is a hot-button topic, obviously, since 9/11, so on and so forth, what we're seeing in the world. And yet, it's no different to what we see in Blackbeard or something like that, Pirates of the Caribbean, if you want to use that as an example. These were savage attacks that wrecked homes, killed people, destroyed property, and yet we kind of tend to think of it as cool. We have Talk Like a Pirate Day. It made me wonder what the next century is going to view our current terrorism situation and how they're going to paint that. But that's a nice little social commentary nugget that was put in there. My real note here is that the pirates are flying canary yellow helicopters. These are guys that are attacking boats at sea, so if you're out in the middle of the sea, what you have is the water, which is going to be dark or reflective, whatever, and then the horizon. And then there's these yellow helicopters coming, allowing them to get enough of an advance warning to maybe fend it off if they have enough defenses. And while that bothers me, I had to think it through because we have to be fair to the story and the context. While I think a stealthier color would have helped, maybe the helicopters were stolen, and they really didn't have the right materials to paint these things, because you can't just slap a regular coat of paint on an aircraft. At least to my knowledge, because that's going to be hitting cold air, it's going to be going through a lot of rigor as it goes through the air. So you can't just go to Earl Scheib and get it painted like a used car. So I kind of understand in context, they got these helicopters, they're pre-painted, they're going to use what they have. Flip that coin, however. And apparently, even in sea-based terrorism, a uniform look is important. I'm about 90% sure it's half their budget from their ill-gotten gains to buy these matching black jumpsuits and red boots and gloves and masks to make sure they're all uniformed correctly. They gotta strike that terror. So basically, they're stealing for the look. They're stealing for fashion, is my suspicion. This ends up being a non-action scene, as Iron Man shows up, and he's in his classic look, and it's over. Now, this classic look I want to talk about for a moment, this, to me, is Iron Man. There have been a ton of great Iron Man designs, especially in the 90s and the 21st century, and they represent what technology would probably look like if you were able to fashion a suit of armor, like Tony Stark did. This doesn't really match that. This is more of a spandex look, or at least not really a spandex because it's going to be metal, but emulating spandex and the traditional superheroes like your Captain America's, your Spider-Man's. There's not a lot of bulk. The tech is more of a mesh, like chainmail, so you get these form-fitted arms and legs, and these iron boots and gloves, and then the chest piece. This is a classic look that stayed fairly static since the 70s with a few attempted amendments, like putting a nose on the mask to make him look more intimidating. Can't make that up. More intimidating. They realized it didn't work and removed it. Oh, and he also had roller skates. Yeah, can't make that up either. He would roll on skates using rockets. Now, for context, it was the 70s, so discos and roller rinks were the rage, so they're wanting to appeal to kids, so it makes sense on a certain level. On another level, it's just completely bonkers and unnecessary. The biggest piece of Tony's armor is this chest apparatus. It fits him kind of like a singlet, where it goes up to his shoulders and kind of gives a sleeveless look. This is in, no pun intended, stark contrast to what we see in the movies, because this is bulky. In the movies, you have Tony who can be bare-chested with an arc reactor in his chest, which is a little weird in and of itself, but it works. Here, this is more true to what the apparatus would be, because this is something like a portable iron lung, at least an analog to that, for Tony's heart. Now, in the real world, an iron lung means somebody is pretty much immobile all the time, and it's horrific. Of course, in the Marvel Universe, it becomes the superhero's source of power. That's how Marvel works. It smacks a little bit more of realism, at least closer to realism, as far as you can go in some of these things. And I also miss the days that Tony had to sit in a chair and literally plug into a wall outlet to charge his chest apparatus. I kid you not, this was a thing. There were many, many panels of Tony just lounging with his suit plugged in. Now, with that in context, I understand why the arc reactor works so much better in the movies. But I think somebody like Robert Downey Jr. could even make sitting there and recharging pretty entertaining. Probably not best to test the audience's patience, though. Suffice it to say, I love this look because it represents more of what I got from that Secret Wars toy, the classic version of Iron Man. Is it his best look? Maybe not. I mean, in the 80s, you had this look, you had the Silver Centurion look, which we're going to see a story at some point with that in it. And towards the latter part of the decade, there was a remodel where you added more bulk to the gauntlets and the gloves. That is actually my favorite look of Iron Man. It seemed to work really well for me. As much as I like this particular version, that version grabbed me. And maybe it's because I was older and able to look a little bit closer at it. Anyway, this was the predominant look for the longest time. This is the iconic Iron Man, if you will. As mentioned, the action scene is over. Iron Man shows up, the pirates are already done, and admittedly, I'm disappointed because I thought this would be a cool moment to show Iron Man fighting bad guys, but I had to realize this would slow down the pacing. There's plenty of action scenes in this issue, including a fight with Dr. Doom. If we stopped here to indulge in an action scene right out of the gate, we're going to delay getting to the good doctor. And then I went further into it and realized this is actually quite genius because it shows Iron Man's power level. These people are nothing to him. He's done and over it before you can really react. For somebody who might be reading Iron Man for the first time, this at least sets him up to be a powerhouse, which when he goes up against Dr. Doom later, for contrast, will make it even more startling and a little bit more galvanizing as far as a fight goes. You know this is a big fight. Now, I also want to fill in here just a little bit. This doesn't come into a lot of relevance in this or the next issue, but for context, the world doesn't know that Tony Stark is Iron Man, in contrast to the movies. At this stage, Tony Stark is the head of Stark International. Not Stark Industries, but Stark International. CEO, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist, all of that that you know. But the world thinks that Iron Man is his official bodyguard. So Iron Man is looked at as an employee of Stark International, as an employee of Stark. So Stark is his own employee. And I would love to see what the taxes are like on that, but they're not going to put that kind of stuff in a comic. That's important because Iron Man instructs the ship to turn around and not deliver their cargo. Which gets explained a little bit later that this cargo was headed for Latveria for Dr. Doom. But I was wondering if Iron Man as an employee has a certain ranking where he can pass along orders like this to turn an entire shipment around. You may well know I'm a fan of the movie Top Gun. While filming Top Gun on an aircraft carrier, Tony Scott needed specific light for nuance, for just the look of the thing, and the ship began to turn one way, away from the sun. So Tony Scott spoke to the captain of the aircraft carrier, asking why are they turning? The captain explained that it costs like $500,000 to turn the ship around. Now in that instance, Tony Scott wrote a check and they turned the ship around and he got his film. In this instance, Tony Stark is losing a ton of money, not just in the sale to Latveria, which he's going to send the money back, but in the shipment and the cost of turning this thing around without collecting. And they do mention that traditional communication channels are out for whatever reason, likely the piracy, I don't know, could be. But it feels like Iron Man delivering this news would be scoffed at a little bit. I definitely raised an eyebrow at that, but it's hard to tell the ranking system. Iron Man must have a lot of latitude for whatever reason. You don't think that would be a clue? And then we move from this opening scene to the boardroom. And you may not believe me when I say this, but I'm dead serious. When I was looking at Iron Man stories to include in coverage in this show, I wanted something with some boardroom action. Admittedly, when looking at superhero comics, going into a corporate boardroom is not at the top of the I want to see it list. But I'm a little bit different. Primarily because it shows Tony Stark in his more native element as a CEO. But also, this is the 80s. You had primetime soaps like Dallas and Dynasty that dealt with this all the time, and I like that analog aspect. This wouldn't be far off from when people were spending a whole summer trying to figure out who shot JR, and I vaguely remember that happening. It was very overwhelming. So to have that aspect in there reflects the pop culture of the time. Now that excitement came to an abrupt halt when I saw Tony in all of his 80s glory and had to just bask in it. He's got a brown suit with a patterned shirt, his big Aquanet hair, and then a porn stash. Let's never forget that Tony sported that mustache for a long, long, long time, well past the point of it being fashionable. You can slap a goatee on him, people, and it looks fine, it looks modern. But if you're looking at the true Tony Stark, that is a mustachioed man. And he's no Tom Selleck or Sam Elliott, he doesn't have a legendary mustache, he's almost, he's barely a Lee Horsley, really. But there he is, looking like he walked off a sitcom where he's the physics teacher teaching a bunch of wild kids about life and science and how those merge. When we get to the boardroom, it does not disappoint, because Tony strikes down Zero, calls him out in front of everybody, and he straight up fires him. And it makes sense, because this guy was making his numbers by selling to the country of Latveria, specifically Dr. Doom. Not only is that morally questionable, but at the same time, it puts Stark International in an area where they could be accused of treason, because they're selling weapons to a hostile nation. And the way Tony calls him out is striking. And then at the end, he says, "Your severance will be generous. Good day." Basically, Tony dismisses him, says, "Deuces, you're out." And they say that the rest of the meeting goes quietly. This is Tony Stark. This is that side of him that Iron Man doesn't always show. That he actually is a shrewd businessman. That he is conscientious to some extent. And he's in charge. He's the boss. It's not Mona. It's not Samantha. Certainly not Tony Danza. It's Tony Stark. Suddenly I want an 80s sitcom with Tony Danza playing a version of Tony Stark. That would be glorious. I'm going to stop myself before I go down that road too far, but I've planted that seed in your brain too. So we move to where we catch up with Dr. Doom, who is visiting with Cagliostro in India in the past, and Dr. Doom is learning magical secrets. His goal? He wants to get his mom out of hell. I'm going to go more into that next time, but to me it's like a new way to post-bail. If I could time travel to post-bail for my mom, I probably would. Michelini is doing a fairly solid deep cut here, because Cagliostro was an existing character who first appeared in 1973. He was in Dracula Lives number 1. There he had gained immortality thanks to using vampire blood, and this particular appearance predates that chronologically. So it puts Doom in a position to help create this villain that would appear elsewhere. I like those little bits of continuity. This is all we're going to see of Cagliostro, so that's about all I've got on him. Dr. Doom is the ideal enemy for anybody in the Marvel Universe. Here, though, like the Secret Wars toys, to put these two toe-to-toe is a no-brainer. Dr. Doom is the ruler of Latveria, so he's got power, and Latveria is, well, we're going to get into it. He's not the ruler currently, he's been deposed, but that's his country. Doesn't matter who's on the throne, it's Doom's country. So like Stark, he's got a lot of power. Of course, they both wear armor. They're both tech geniuses. So there's a lateral idea between these two. The only thing that really changes it that makes Doom a challenge in a good way is that he's learning magic. And I forget how good of an artist Romita really was, Romita Jr. And it's not that he's a bad artist now, it's just not to my taste. He's changed his style. But here, there is this boss shot of Dr. Doom being lit by fire. There's a point where I really, really love John Romita art, and it just speaks to me. And that's going right up to the end of his Daredevil arc. I mean, I would include Daredevil Man Without Fear, the miniseries. That's when he started introducing the sort of scritchy, scratchy look. That continued to evolve into more geometric shapes and something that kind of lost me along the way. And more power to him, he's getting work, go for it. But I forget just how much I really, really liked his art. It just dawned on me, this isn't in my notes, but Dr. Doom is pulling a Biff Tannen and it just hit me. He's changing the time stream to fit his favor, essentially. Now imagine the potential of this time travel. Think about this. I'm going to follow this thread here. But Dr. Doom has a time platform. Why does he not go into the past and kill that accursed Richards? Or Steve Rogers? Or Bruce Banner? Or just have gone back and killed Tony Stark in his sleep? Now the real answer to that, even though Doom has the power to do this, and Doom has the power to do a lot of things. At one point I'm going to cover the Emperor Doom graphic novel and you're going to see just how far he can take this. To summarize, he can back up his words. Here, though, this is actually exploiting Doom's weakness. The fact that his sole focus is his mother. It shows a certain sweet side to Dr. Doom. It also shows a certain lack of vision that this is his sole obsession. So to me, this time machine could be used for self-serving purposes to Dr. Doom, but that wouldn't be a challenge for him. To get his mom out of the afterlife is a whole different ballgame. Of course, the big plot hole is that he could just go back in time and tell his mom not to take a deal with Mephisto that landed her in hell, but that would be killing a story before it even happens. I mentioned the time platform. It's a very cool effect. A square descends over the person and they transition as it goes over them. Very cool effect. Now let me switch back to Iron Man, because he has nothing better to do than wait for Doom, apparently. He knows Doom's going to come for the parts that he had brought back to the US, so he's simply waiting by the seaside warehouse for Doom. I'm sure nothing else was going on in Tony Stark's life that day at all. Although that actually might be true. I was being sarcastic, but he mentions earlier in the book that his current girlfriend, Bethany, is off on some secret mission. And since Tony Stark is currently a recovering alcoholic, prior to another relapse that'll come down the road, it's probably best that he does sit here and wait. It gives him something to do. That also means that Dr. Doom is quite predictable. Now, that's true, but Dr. Doom knows he's predictable and does a pivot. Oh, you see that boat out there? You think that's me? Nope, here's a submarine, sucker! Bam! Doom thought ahead, and the sub is geared to take out Iron Man, very specifically to take out Iron Man. He knew Iron Man would be there, so he's put all the pieces on the board. And Iron Man is no match for this. He's not killed, thankfully. He does outthink it just enough to save his own skin, but he doesn't stop what Doom really wants. His booster circuits to get back to the past. He's looking at Iron Man as just this ant that's right in the way. So here's where the rubber meets the road. About midway through the issue, a little bit over, Tony flies in his private jet to Latveria. Here's where I got to fire up Google Maps. You know, if you've listened to my previous show, I love Google Maps, and since the Marvel Universe uses the real world as a template, it's pretty easy to locate things. Latveria's at the southwest portion of Romania. In fact, Romania wraps around the northern half, bordering Transylvania and Serbia. Now, this is something where Tony Stark is based out of Long Island, so he flies from Long Island to Latveria, which is just shy of 5,000 miles. Now, I did the flight path, and there are probable stop-offs in the UK to refuel in Germany, maybe, kind of using a northern curve flight path. So even in pre-9/11 times, there would have to have been a flight plan that would have been registered, with all stops, including the destination. It shows Stark took 8 hours to get there. New York to London is about 6.5 hours, so this is actually quite true. Now I'm factoring in private airstrips in this. Tony Stark's not going to stop at Heathrow and get out and go through customs and reboard. This is a private jet. They stop, they refuel, they move forward. And who do we have flying the plane? James Rhodey Rhodes, who you may know from the movies as Don Cheadle, originally Terrence Howard, but that's a little bit of an awkward subject, and he gets a cameo here. Rhodey was a newer character at this time. Nobody knew where it would go, and it went somewhere beautiful. Tony hands the Iron Man over to Rhodey at one point due to Tony's alcoholism, and of course he becomes War Machine, so he's a very key character, even though right now he hasn't been fleshed out yet. But they're not traveling Indiana Jones style via Arrow, they actually show up at Latveria, and Tony gets a shock when the Latverian Royal Guard confronts him. It looks bad, it is scary. Doom is currently deposed by Zorba, as I mentioned, but everybody knows, Victor is coming back. You can't keep Victor down. Victor Von Doom doesn't stay down. But the current ruler wants to know if Tony needs any help messing with Doom. And this immediately puts Tony Stark and Iron Man in a place to be a political tool. Let me comment on that for just a moment. I mentioned at the top of the show how Iron Man is something of a Cold War relic that's been advanced to be more evergreen. But the core of Iron Man is in the Cold War. This makes Iron Man, by default, a political character. Not through a lot of commentary, but just by sheer concept and his placement in the Cold War scheme of things, of the Marvel Universe, and the analog to the real world. Even in his early stories, from his origin, which was in Vietnam, hot-button topic at the time that he was created, you also have the invasion of Russian spies. This character, by design, is hard to dodge politics. I know what you're thinking, doesn't Captain America involve politics? Yeah, but Cap weaves those a little bit more because of his ideals, that he's a dreamer, that he's looking more at the American dream than the American reality. There's some political in there, especially down the road in the 2000s, but really, by design, Cap is more of a symbol than an actual political figure. Iron Man, however, being an industrialist, being a weapons manufacturer, and a tech manufacturer, puts himself right in the firing line for the Cold War. To give you an idea of the Cold War, the core of it was, in the 50s through the 80s, who had the bigger, faster, and more accurate weapons? Tony Stark does in the Marvel Universe. That means Tony has to be extremely careful with where he goes and what he does, just as a public figure, but also because he could be a powerful ally to any country. If Tony Stark defected to the USSR, that would be a big bad for America. Get what I'm saying? So that puts Tony in a weird spot here. Tony is traveling to Latveria. This could be a big hot-button issue because that area is full of strife at this time. There's power struggles, so on and so forth, and we don't exactly know where Latveria sits in terms of ally or enemy. So while Tony's there to simply reclaim Stark property and keep it out of Dr. Doom's hands, suddenly he's a potential savior of a nation. Oh, you're here to mess with Dr. Doom. We will help you. That is bad because Tony is very much a US-based figure. Which means that, by the court of public opinion, the U.S. is intervening in international politics. This in no way, shape, or form is Tony's intent, but Tony is, to put it lightly, intelligent. To put it more accurately, extreme genius intelligence. He had to know that he was sitting in a political hotbed that could blow up in his face. This particular act didn't sit well with me initially. I had to think it through. Which, if a comic makes me think, I'm already a fan. So why did Tony go to Latveria to claim this, when he could have gone through political channels? Well, since Doom had been refunded the funds, this is now stolen property. This is international theft, which you could take to the UN and solve through diplomatic channels. However, Doom is not currently the ruler, which means Zorba would have to confront Doom. That is risking a huge potential civil war that would break out, and Doom would win, because he always wins, and get the throne back sooner than he already would. So as politically shaky as this is, there wasn't really another channel in the diplomatic community. Also, let's flip that coin. If Tony gave a news conference, go through Stark PR, that would just destroy the reputation of the entire firm. Because, essentially, Dr. Doom is clearly up to something. Tony's materials are used. That puts the company in a bad place where they might be accused of treason, aiding up an enemy. So from the diplomatic standpoint, potential civil war, or worse. From the business standpoint, bad PR, bad business, and treason against the whole company, which could put a bunch of people out of work, if not immediately, over time. So eventually that did sit well with me when I was able to go through those paths and realize that Tony is betting that Dr. Doom is reverting to pure villain mode, and he's not there to make any political noise. He's betting on Dr. Doom using his might versus Dr. Doom using his politics and starting something that could be very, very bad. So the army is there, they're offering their services. I love that the general looks like Thunderbolt Ross from the Hulk. I just imagine that there's a Thunderbolt Ross in all standing armies across the world, and that mustache is standard issue, kind of like the buzz cut, but the cigar is optional. Now imagine one of these guys getting drummed out of the army that they are serving. They have to take a clippers and swipe that mustache. The general starts crying, has to walk out like Richard Gere in Officer and a Gentleman. Anyway, here I have to also point out, the whole politics thing aside, that there's a major plot hole here. So Tony Stark shows up through civilian channels and then vanishes. So Iron Man shows up moments later and Tony's vanished. So Tony leaves the airport, goes right to the armor, goes right to Doom. I mean, he's down to business, which makes sense, but there's nothing to account for Tony Stark's whereabouts. And I check next issue, there's no real resolution to that, and the issue after that doesn't even mention it. So somehow he had to come back, go back to Tony Stark, and end up flying back to the US without anybody noticing, hey, Tony's gone, Iron Man's here, maybe they're the same person. This is a bad maintenance of your secret identity, Tony. For shame. As we get to the latter part of the issue, we get to Castle Doom, which has some awesome defenses, like a refractory field to fool the eyes. You can't go in if you can't find the door, and this refractory field makes it impossible to find the door, like a funhouse. So there's no guards out there, so it kind of shows Dr. Doom's ego and his faith in his science. Which, for most armies, most intruders, this would work, but then Iron Man just saunters right in like he owns the place. And Doom has no illusions about his illusions. Although he likes his science, the refractory field is great, he sends only 3 Doombots to confront Iron Man when he enters. Iron Man just walks right through them as well, so doesn't do much, but I love the design of these Doombots. It's very insect-like. It's a cross between Ambush Bug and Annihilus, and I think this really shows how good Romita can do tech. And there's an element of Kirby tech in Romita's designs that I never noticed before, but now I really, really appreciate after this issue. And do you want to sound like a boss even when your enemy has rolled into your lair? Dr. Doom is your role model. Iron Man walks in, Doom doesn't even turn around and says, "What do you want, errand boy?" Boom! You're owned, Iron Man. And Doom uses a molecular expander, which I think is really neat. It expands molecules into the size of boulders. We're talking like atomic molecules. So dust becomes disaster. As neat as it is, I'm going to have to call foul because that's a play from Ant-Man's book. But Iron Man reverses the polarity of his outer shell, therefore reversing the magnetic charge, which drives the molecules away. But it does give him a moment because Doom is surprised and stunned for the first time in this fight that Iron Man was able to break free. The one move Iron Man did that he did not expect. So Doom is surprised, he's staggering. But Iron Man has an opening and he uses his strongest blast on Doom. This is a blast that, according to the book, can go through several dozen walls. And the effect? He's made Doom mad. Do not mess with the Maestro, people. Because immediately, Iron Man has an opening and he's on the back foot almost as soon as it opens. And then the fight gets going full force. And for the first half of the page, it's basic fisticuffs. Then Doom starts sending electricity through Iron Man's armor and the shell head has to match him, which is intense. That's very much like the Spider-Man video game. Iron Man is trying to match him to keep the polarity at the same place so it doesn't get to him. It just cancels out. That's very good. That's very interesting, but it's cut short a little bit too soon because Chekhov's gun goes off. The disgruntled scientist, Hotman, finally gets his moment to strike and sends both Doom and Iron Man on a one-way ticket to the past. I feel like this fight was just starting and I think it had a lot more room to grow, but it's cut short. And of course, it's perfect irony that Dr. Doom's machine was built with Tony's components. So Dr. Doom is defeated, but he takes Iron Man with him, with the machine that Iron Man helped build. To get down to it, this is a surprisingly packed issue. We get some boardroom action, pirates, robotic machines, international intrigue, a fight with the villain, and a gas-worthy cliffhanger. There really is not much fat on this bone. Iron Man's motivations may be straightforward, but Dr. Doom's motivations are a little bit more buried. Those motivations are touched on, they're acknowledged, but I can't help but feel that it was brushed aside a bit and got lost in a crowded issue. I felt like I wanted more from what Dr. Doom was doing and the emotional resonance of that, but it was a rich backdrop that could have done with a little bit more breathing room. Also, for an issue that was published before the internet, newer Marvel readers could have done with more explanation on Doom's mission to get his mom out of hell. We will get more of that next time, but it could have helped here at the onset. I will concede that the pacing of this issue would have possibly been hampered by this, but maybe a few more thought balloons or editor's notes could have done the job, assuming that it could be subtle. To the pacing, Michelini manages to give us a redacted but efficient battle at the top of the issue, another one in the midsection before the final confrontation with Dr. Doom. To his credit, the scene where Tony is accosted by the Latverian army at the airport managed to actually get the pulse racing without adding another action beat, and providing exposition at the same time, which is really solid, deft storytelling. But the real treat, in all honesty, was the John Romita Jr. art. Romita would evolve his style into something more like Frank Miller, and that meant big, square figures, scratchy style, deep pockets of shadow, that whole thing. But here in the early days, there were hints of that squared-off style, but his layouts were sharp. The detail in the art is brilliant, his Iron Man looks sleek and shiny, but I can't escape the idea that this issue was serving solely as a setup for next issue. That's a good read in and of itself, and we get a tussle between the hero and villain, but it's primarily prologue. An exciting prologue that engages the reader, but a prologue. And that can be forgiven. It's part of the nature of an ongoing periodical to get them to buy the next issue. So, there is the question. Removing the fact that we know I am covering the next issue next time, would I read the next issue? Maybe. Probably not. That's not to say it isn't a good cliffhanger, but if I'd bought this off the comic rack, it wouldn't compel me to search out the next one. I know they're going to get out of this. It's just a question of how. But when it comes down to it, the real question, the real meat here is, what does this score on the highly sophisticated Weeder meter? It looks like this issue, Iron Man number 149, lands square in the middle, a 2.5. Average entertainment, good art, good issue, but not a must-own without its second chapter, which we're going to be talking about next time. And with that, our first two-parter comes to a middle. Of course, we'll be looking at Iron Man number 150 next time. Until next time, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall to your heart. I am J. David Weeder. Thanks for stopping by my Marvel Universe. This show is made for entertainment purposes only and does not draw revenue from the material discussed. All opinions are those of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other individual, entity, or organization. Music is provided by Danya Valdovas. It is used based on a royalty-free agreement. For links to the artist's other works, please visit davesmarveluniverse.com. All other music or sound clips are believed used under fair use and are used for entertainment and illustrative purposes only. Copyrights lie with the copyright holders and no infringement is intended. If you're into the social medias, the show does have a Facebook page. Just search out Dave's Marvel Universe on Facebook. Or you can find me on Twitter, at Dave Weeder. Weeder is spelled W-E-T-E-R. Show notes, links to other podcatcher feeds, and much more are available at davesmarveluniverse.com, the home base for the show.